Erlem Sports.
Hello and welcome to the Verulam Sport Podcast. Every week, the team behind the award-winning Radio Verulam Sports Show will provide you with the most relevant news from the local and regional sporting scenes, whilst keeping you in the picture with national and international bulletins from the world of sport. There will be topical debates, regular interviews from local talent, and chats with those big-name guests that are a mainstay of Verulam Sport. As always, this is your show, every bit as much as it is ours. So, check out Verulam Sport across social media and get involved. For now, prepare yourself for this week's action-packed Verulam Sport Podcast.
Hello again and welcome to 92.6 FM, where every week between 6 and 7pm, the team behind the award-winning Verulam Sports are going to give to you, based on your suggestions, an in-depth sporting debate, analysis and dissection. Looking forward to this week's particular topic. You've asked us to consider the nature of the evolving spectators' experience of sport. Obviously, in this challenging time that we're living through, empty stadia and all of that, it's kind of brought that into the focus. Now, more than ever, teams are having to pivot, to evolve, to consider how they can safely and, more importantly, encourage and enhance the spectators' experience. It's going to be a fascinating one. And no, as always, you are awash with your own opinions on this beautiful topic. So keep involved. Always remember, don't ever forget, this is your show. Each and every single bit, as much as it is ours. So, to continue to stay involved, tweet us at Verulam Sport. Love hearing from you. Can't wait to get the top lines from the machine. Jason McKenna from social media already on everything to do with how you think sports teams are adapting and will continue to adapt and evolve our experiences of live sport interaction. Looking forward to this one. And again, always a pleasure to interact with our machine, Jason McKenna. Jason, good evening. And again, busy social media time. I know they're keeping you busy, our listeners. What do you got for us?
Yeah, as always, I'm so impressed by like the diverse nature of what our listeners get involved with. You know, the things that they send in, they're thought-provoking and also, you know, bring us on to things that maybe we wouldn't have considered before. Now, Richard has said people should be allowed into stadiums. I think he's talking about COVID-19 here, and this is something that we will tease out, and this is the only one that I'm putting in because, again, like last week, we are going to address the kind of COVID elephant in the room with it all. So he said people should be allowed into stadiums, rotary it to make it fair that everybody can go in. But this is necessary for keeping our local clubs alive. I think this is a sentiment that we can agree with. And I would add to that, that it's also keeping the game alive because it's so, so different. And I would say a bit negative without the fans there. Now, Michael has chipped in and he said there are too many armchair managers. And the bad thing is that clubs are listening to them too much. The future of spectators is that hopefully we see less from them impinging on the ability of teams. But sadly, it feels like fans are too entitled to too much opinion. So that's quite an interesting one there. Anne has said there will be more multi-purpose stadiums like Tottenham's. So no more one sports stadiums, possibly franchise clubs too. And she suggests that maybe Tottenham might have their own NFL team. I think that's something that you'll want to tease out there, Tony. And Samantha, with the final word here, from the amazing amount of messages from everybody, there might be less real fans at clubs because they can only afford to watch on the TV. This is something that maybe a lot of Arsenal fans have experienced, but I think this is going to be a problem going forward. But maybe on that and kind of comment there, Tony, can you see Tottenham being an NFL team?
It's a great suggestion. The short answer is, and I don't rule anything out, I don't think it will be a Tottenham franchise. I think there's a very strong case that that Tottenham could well be the base when I'm sure there will be a London-based franchise. Again, not this year for the global situation scenario, but there has been, and there's a commitment to continuing the international series. And I've been honoured and privileged to be at Wembley a few times over the last few years to witness the international series. There's such an appetite for the NFL. It's growing. There's such a kind of increased passion for it. I think this international series has almost served as a acid test for the appetite for a franchise here in London. And also, more importantly, before it became, quote unquote, the norm, as we've experienced over the last 6, 7, 8 years now, there was always the logistical concerns about the time difference, the jet lag, etc., etc. But all of that seems to be well managed now. I think it's embraced by the NFL teams who come over. I just think it's almost inevitable that there will be a London-based franchise, and really looking forward to that. Very strong chance it could well be based at the Tottenham Arena. But I suspect they'll also maybe float between maybe Twickenham and also Wembley. We were talking last week, weren't we, Jason, in the economics of sport discussion about maybe the concerns of having these massive stadia, Twickenham, Wembley, which for all too often are essentially massive arenas with nobody to have anything to witness. So I think there's a case to be made that all these interact and they kind of share the resource, share the wealth that will come. But yeah, I'm convinced in the next 5 years, 10 years maximum, there will be an NFL franchise based out of London. I don't know whether, as our listeners suggested via social media, that that will be almost an extension of the brand Tottenham Hotspur. My gut feeling on that one is unlikely, but yeah, I'm convinced it will be a reality. And I'm excited for it because, you know, we're talking this week fan experience. The NFL are leaps and bounds ahead of many in terms of that. They take it very, very seriously. And I think having access to that, not just for a finite amount of time in this international series, but almost on a bi-weekly basis during the season, it can only be beneficial. And I think the sharing of the resource and the knowledge to enhance spectators' experiences is only going to be beneficial for all sport. So yeah, Jason, that's my take on that. But I'm excited to dig deeper into the virtual fan experience and the evolving fan experience. But talking spectators, I think it would be remiss of us not to ask maybe the most burning question on all sports fans' lips this very week. Where will spectators be witnessing one of the all-time greats, Lionel Messi, playing in his trade, obviously, in not in American football, but in football? Your thoughts, Jason, as to where the great Argentine could well be plying his trade next season and beyond?
Goodness me, Tony. I mean, it is going to be a fierce debate going all through until the start of the season, which is very close. And obviously, when the transfer season kind of ends, there's a lot of debate about whether he can actually leave Barcelona on a free. If not, it'll be interesting to see if anybody matches this 700 million buyout clause. But I think probably if Messi wants out, it'll be lowered just a little bit, to say the least. But in terms of my opinion, I think the realistic nature of football is obviously governed by football. It'd be amazing to see him at St. Albans City next year, but I don't think that'll be happening for the Saints. I mean, it would be an absolute miracle if it was. But in terms of the actual kind of realistic prospects, there's only a few teams. I think Juventus seem to be big spenders, but I think the realistic team in Italy is actually Inter Milan. They seem to have the big bucks now because of Chinese owners. PSG, because we know that they're absolutely minted to the top. They've got two of the most expensive players of all time. Can they make it a third with Messi? But I think the most realistic option, if he's going to move, this could all be part of a power play to force out the incumbent president of Barcelona. But I think the most realistic move is actually to Manchester City. It would make sense in terms of footballing, meeting up with Guardiola again, possibly pushing for Champions League and the league, you know, they were so dominant under Guardiola a season before and the season before that. It just makes sense. It's the style that Messi's used to. But I don't know, can you add anything to that, Tony? I mean, do you think that this is a real prospect that Messi's going to finally leave Barcelona?
This is the hot topic of the week. That's why we've brought it up here. And it's really fascinating. I mean, look, let's not lose sight of the fact of what a world great he is. You know, four Champions League, I think some 630 plus goals in just under 800 games. So his goal to game ratio is astonishing. He's an all-time great. There's no questions about it. But he holds massive political sway at Barcelona. Now, here's the thing. Anybody who saw the Champions League this season will have seen an aging Barcelona side, and Messi himself is the wrong side of 30 these days. So time is not his best friend, but they were absolutely shellacked by eventual winners, Bayern Munich. And it was an excruciating performance to witness. Lack of energy, lack of passion, lack of ideas. So this is a Barcelona team that needs a massive reboot. Does Messi really have the time on his side to be part of that? But as you referenced, he's obviously had for some time, and it's been manageable when things are successful, a bit of an ambivalent relationship with their current president. And I can see him making a power move to get rid of the president. But here's where it gets fascinating. There's talk of, if that were to come to the case, that the new president would instill Xavi, obviously an ex-Barcelona manager, a great, who Messi knows very well indeed, as the manager. But obviously that in and of itself gets very weird, because they've currently got instilled another very good manager, Koeman, who is obviously from that Dutch school that you know and admire so greatly. So question would be, if they got rid of the manager, instilled a new the president, instilled a new manager, does that make everything okay? I'm not sure it does. I really don't. And I don't think it's a magic wand. So really, I think he is brokering some things. And I think if that eventuality came to pass, again, he would get, no doubt, a mega payday to end his career as a Barcelona player. I could see him kind of taking solace in that. But he's got all the money in the world. He needs more trophies to kind of compete with that other one, Ronaldo, who obviously they go toe-to-toe as the greatest of this era. I think if he were to move, that Man City connection, reuniting with Pep, and they can afford it, obviously they can, makes a lot of sense. And whilst I've referenced that he is in the twilight of his career, and again, it was a very sad sight, Messi et al., being schooled in that semi-final defeat, he's still got several more years in him, I think, at the very, very highest level. And if Pep could eke that out of him, well, watch out, Klopp, watch out the rest of Europe. Because with De Bruyne laying it on our man Aguero as well besides him, I mean, it's a mouth-watering prospect, isn't it? So, yeah, I'd love to see that. I really would, as an objective, obviously, Englishman fan of the Premier League. But my gut feeling is that this is a power brokering time in quote-unquote silly season, and watch this space. But right now, it's the time, space, and indeed the place to get underway with our thoughts on the evolving enhancements that will be normal as we progress and have a new appreciation for sports participation and spectatorship. Jason, what have you got? What's your initial thoughts here?
Yeah, so I actually have kind of a discussion point surrounding fan involvement in the decisions of sports clubs. So I've kind of been inspired by the Arsenal great Arsene Wenger and one of his quotes that he said, in a few years, fans on social networks will get to decide half-time substitutions. Now, it's kind of prophetic because actually, a little bit before Arsene Wenger said that, there was Ebbsfleet United. Now, I'm not sure if you kind of au fait with this project, but it was called the My Football Club Project. And it was ran by a former football kind of journalist. And basically, he raised £500,000 through PayPal. And then all these 32,000 members were then in charge of Ebbsfleet United, kind of their transfers, manager, team pickings. Like, this sounds like a logistical nightmare. But funnily enough, actually kind of looking at it, they decided quite often to leave it up to the manager to make these big decisions. But the project fell through in 2013 because a lot of people, you know, the nature of being down in the conference, as we know with the Saints, is that you yo-yo up, you yo-yo down. It's not always a positive upward trajectory. It's a very hard thing to manage. And a lot of people just got bored because they're like, well, I put my money in, I want my money out. I don't really care about Ebbsfleet United now that they haven't got to the Premier League in 2 years, you know. People need to manage their expectations. But this was like the first kind of fan-run football project in the UK where they totally had control of the club. And, you know, this can be chalked off as a little bit of a failure, but also an insight into maybe the future of management. You know, we might not see total control of a club, but you often see armchair managers saying, oh, I'd do a better job if I was in charge at the weekend. But I'm linking this as well to actually Formula E. Now, this is the electric, eco-friendly cousin of Formula One, and they have lots of Formula One drivers there. But they have a thing called Fan Boost. Now, this is most fascinating to me because the fans actually play an active role in influencing the outcome of the race. The favourite driver of the day or the best driver, people vote for it, and whoever wins this vote gets the extra boost of power for the last few laps on the track. Now, I think, you know, we can tease this out, Tony, but I think there's going to be a real kind of investment in this involvement with fans as these clubs become behemoths and transcending multiple sports, you know, because you see the likes of Barcelona having basketball teams, you know, hockey teams. I think as they grow bigger and less connected with the fan, they will try and reinforce this so-called connection by actually saying, oh, you can decide on this or decide on that. Maybe it'll be on a micro level where they decide from free choices of next year's kit or something like that. I don't think realistically they'll decide who's going to buy what, because that would be an absolute nightmare. But I think this is the future of sport. They're going to have to get people involved because they can't have people feeling too disconnected. I don't know if that's a remedy, Tony. I don't know your thoughts and feelings. Or is this kind of the failure of My Football Club and Ebbsfleet United just shows that fans can't be in control of clubs?
Well, first of all, as we always say, I know you listening are an absolute footballing and sporting genius. You've got all the answers. You've got all the right selections. You know the best formations. And yeah, want your views on this, because, again, that could well be the future. So tweet us at Verulam Sport with your views on everything virtual fan experience. Now, got to tell you, Jason, you made some critical points there. And I was fascinated to hear about the Ebbsfleet project and really fascinated by the incentive and the kind of the interaction between the fans and their ability to influence the booster quality in the Formula E world. Just on the latter first, obviously Formula E has to compete with the behemoth that is the brand F1. So they have to be PR savvy. They have to come up with these ideas. And I like that in the sense that, again, that is the interaction, and it has a tangible, recognizable, influential quality in real time when the favorite driver doesn't necessarily need to be the one at the lead. It could be a driver that's impressed, maybe driving from the back. And then they get the benefits of that boost. I like that. As to whether I think the Ebbsfleet project could well become almost the early stages, or maybe we look back in history and point out that was when everything pivoted and was almost the archetype of this new wave of fan interaction. I'm dubious about how far this could be extrapolated. Like we always say, everybody's a genius sat at home. But the facts of the matter is this. The reason that the great managers are able to be exactly that is that they have also, as well as churning and chunking and analyzing all the data, they have that gut feeling. And we see it all the time when they make a substitution and it has that influential quality. And that's a quality that unless you are there in real time, you can't understand. And also, even if you are there as a fan in real time, unless you're seeing what people are doing on the training pitch or their own kind of qualities, you can't know that. And it's only the manager, or, you know, in this kind of franchise-esque world, the head coach, who gets to witness all these players and knows all about their potential and when to apply them. So I'd be very wary about moving that scope to the democracy of fan choice, particularly, as you say, I mean, the logistics of it are absolutely crazy. What if it, you know, what if they want to make sweeping changes, but it's coming out spread across the board? Do you go for the highest vote, or, you know, what happens then if there's an injury? It's a logistical nightmare. But what you've introduced wonderfully, and I think this is going to be something that we have been forced into, but I think it's going to become ever more critical in this post CV19 world that we're working towards from a sports perspective. And that is to make sure that the brand, the franchise, the team, however you want to consider it, are seen to be open and the voice and the forum for fan interaction and engagement. And that is going to be critical. I like your shout, maybe, of having the ability of fans to influence things to do with choice of kit, colour, etc., etc. Because it sounds nominal, but again, it's a fan choice interaction, and the power of the internet, and it's only going to get in, you know, more dramatically trending upwards in this way, is that it is the voice of the fan. And right now, we mustn't forget how critical that is going to be, not just now, but moving forwards. So I absolutely love that, Jason. Don't think it's going to go remarkably to the nth degree, but I think you've introduced wonderfully to the piece this need for fans to engage with the club and the club to be seen, to be listening, and to being a true emblem for the minds and the voices of that critical fan base. Love the thought.
Yeah, and I think also you've really hit a point there, which is really important, that a lot of fans, I don't think, understand. And it's kind of been discussed more recently with the mental health discussions around mm-hmm. football, which is fantastic. But quite often, you look at players like Danny Rose. Now, he wasn't being selected by Tottenham, and people thought, oh, he's got an injury or he's fallen out with the manager. But actually, it turned out that he was going through experiencing very bad depression. Now, again, with this fan, my club, United, whatever idea, it would be wrong. It would probably be irresponsible if the players were then trying to choose this player and the club then had to say, look, he's got a mental health issue. You know, by being almost a shareholder, they'd probably say, we demand this information. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, this is private medical issues that maybe he'll want to discuss with his manager, maybe not. You know, it's up to his choice, his discretion. His or her. You know, this could happen in female sport as well. But the whole point is that, yeah, there's so many issues here. But the idea of the kit kind of thing being voted for, I think, is a really fun thing, because recently I actually bought a kit that was designed by a young child in Italy to raise money for coronavirus nurses, you know, all the people who did fantastically well in Italy, the health service there. And one of the teams out in Italy are actually going to play with this child design kit, which is really colourful, happy, positive, you know, encapsulating all the feelings that you want. And I think this is, like you said there, Tony, this is probably the way that they can allow people to have some control over the club. But it's also quite exacerbating, you know, from the outside as a fan to say, I've got no control of my club. So it's going to be interesting to see where this goes, because I think there is a huge demand now from the likes of Arsenal Fan TV or these other forums, like you've rightly said there, where fans come and they say, we've got no control of our club. This is terrible. You know, we could make better decisions. And, you know, sometimes it's right, but they don't know the ins and outs, the workings of the club. So I think this is going to get to a head where they're going to need to give some sort of olive branch. And I'm not sure where it's going to come from. So maybe kit choices. But will that be enough to suffice these fans, Tony? What else can a club actually do? I know we're focusing on football. Maybe you can bring in rugby as well. But is there actually any logistical and logical way that clubs can go, right, you can make this one decision, but this is a fan decision? Or is it literally, unfortunately, the nature of the game? Football is a business and they need business people who know how to actually run these things to take control.
It's a great, great question. I think what they will need to continue to do is acknowledge through social media and whatever it may be, when fans are unhappy. And we've used Arsenal as an example. We've focused on football, but quite frankly, that spans all sports in the digital arena, in the digital era. And if they are not acknowledging that, well, that only begets more trolling, and it kind of goes the other way, where individuals, as opposed to a collective, express their disdain, but maybe apply that ignorantly, I would argue, towards individual players or to the manager or whatever it may be. So more must be done to allow and to acknowledge frustrations, and then to be very, very open, because I find generally that people are reasonable when they are being being delivered reasons. And so, you know, if it is the case that, you know, we are increasing season tickets because of X, and that we don't necessarily need to know the minutiae, but we just need to know the rationale. And this is our philosophy. We're accepted. For instance, let's say a Norwich, obviously they got relegated from the Premier League, but everybody acknowledges that they were a breath of fresh air in many ways. And so I could imagine there would be some fan backlash, because as you've said, and we've experienced, there is the short-termism in so many people's mindsets, and this kind of, again, poorly managing one's own expectations. But again, if that frustration was heard, but then openly, a kind of open forum, these days we access Zoom and all kinds of possibilities, and was acknowledged and said, look, we hear you. We understand your frustration. Ideally, we would have liked to have been a Premiership team playing this philosophy, but we're backing the manager. We're committed to this vision, and we're convinced if you stick with us, we're going to be better in the long run. And again, I think you're going to get whatever it is. There's going to be those that are just, you can't please everybody, can you? It's as simple as that. And everybody wants everything yesterday. It's just the human nature. But I think generally, if people and teams are open and are allowing fans into at least the rationalization of their plans, and how the fans are crucial to those plans, then I think generally you're going to get a sense of more of an ease, more of an awareness, and more of a, yeah, we are involved here. And that's critical. I think an interesting point, though, on this is I suspect this could well, ironically, be quite good for the lower tier teams, the likes of the Mighty Saints. And make sure you are listening to 92.6 FM and checking out the Saints links. We will be following their action all season long, every home game. So exciting times from that regard. But I just use the Saints to anchor this point. I think a lot of people who are feeling disenfranchised from these big brands, these bigger clubs in all sports, will seek that sense of physical engagement at a level like the Saints, where, again, they're not going to necessarily get that ability to change the manager or what have you, but at least where they have that closer interconnection, where the fan and the team are almost as a vital, cohesive, total part of a community. I think that's very critical going forwards. And as always, forward-thinking people that you are, football geniuses that you are, and indeed sporting gurus, want to keep you involved. Tweet us at Verulam Sports. Your views, please, on everything to do with enhancing the fan experience. Do your clubs listen to you? Are you a little bit vexed at the moment? If so, why? Get involved. Tweet at Verulam Sport. Keep involved. Coming back, though, now to a slightly different point. The NBA has embraced certain technologies to at least circumvent the empty stadia issue that was addressed really early in this piece. And I think this is something that could well become, quote unquote, part of the new norm. It's embracing Microsoft technology and enables essentially virtually you to be present at the NBA games in their playoffs as they've reached from the living room. I know Watford and a whole heap of other Premier League teams were offering that to a select number last season in the rebooted Premier League. And I think this is something that's going to be very, very much prevalent because, as you've said, Jason, the massive arena with nobody there at all is horrible. And I know they flirted, they dabbled with piping in sounds from the fans. And I just thought it was a little bit farcical. I don't think yet this augmented reality and this kind of fan interfacing with the ground, I don't think that's necessarily going to make things infinitely better. But it's interesting that it isn't pie in the sky and it is indeed literally in the NBA now happening. But what I think is critical about this, Jason, and I'd love your thoughts on this, is one thing that sport is a global event. It's a global interaction. Okay. And if you are a fan of, you know, any, you pick a name and a sporting brand entity, whether it's Arsenal, Manchester City, or in rugby, Saracens, you just, you know, choose your analog. The point is, if you're a fan of that brand and you can't ever get to the UK or Real Madrid or whatever it is, like I say, it could be any sport, any place, anywhere in the world, but you have the ability to pay some money, contribute, and you have that ability to be part of the live action, well, that's doing what sports teams must do now. I'd say now more than ever, which isn't just be considering their local community fan base, but understanding their place in the global picture. So, Jason, your thoughts in virtual fan interaction and its place in context in the global picture.
Yeah, I think it's really important. I think it's a great idea as well. And before I kind of analyse it, I do want to say what really, really annoys me is, you know, often people kind of go, oh, you're not a real fan because you're not based in X country or this and that. Yeah. But I would say some of the most dedicated, loyal and insightful fans to certain clubs, you know, we were talking to the really talented London is Blue podcast in the build-up, you know, with our fantastic stuff towards the FA Cup final. Those guys have to wake up at silly o'clock to support Chelsea FC. And my goodness, you know, if you say that they're not a fan, then what is a fan? Getting up to support your club at all hours, at all kinds of days in the week, mucking up your sleep pattern just so that you can see those 11 men on the pitch supporting your side. So I think for myself, the fact that they are finally kind of tapping into this global audience is fantastic, because I do get a little bit disappointed when clubs kind of focus just on the encompassing their local area, which, you know, they have to do. That's where the club is from and those are the people that are supporting it physically. But across the globe, you know, Arsenal, Man United, Man City, but even other clubs in other sports, Saracens, I'm sure they've got fantastic Australian fans, you know, that they are all over the world. And the only times that these clubs are seen by their fans across the world is if, in a very rare occasion, they have a world tour over there. Mm-hmm. And it's quite heartbreaking. And, you know, so many fans, you hear these amazing stories of somebody that saved up for 3 or 4 years just to go to see Arsenal once. They go with their family to see Man City on a few occasions, or, you know, if they go to, I don't know, play in Kazakhstan or something in the Europa League, then loads of fans go and enjoy it. So I think you've really hit on something that I think is a positive trend that we've seen in COVID-19. And, you know, it has been a horrendous time for clubs up and down the country. But this engagement with actually fans, hopefully around the world, I'm not sure if they're doing it at the moment, but if this opens the door for global engagement, I can't see a bad thing. And also, you know, it helps combat prejudices, racism as well. If you're seeing somebody from Egypt or something supporting your club, you might think twice about saying, you know, detrimental things. We've seen plenty of studies in Liverpool when Mo Salah scores, anti-Islamic kind of sentiment actually skyrockets down. It's brilliant. So I think there's a lot of positives that can be had from actually allowing a global audience to engage with their clubs and make them feel part of it. You know, I was a little bit kind of down in the first, my fan involvement in the decisions of sports, that, you know, clubs are getting too far away. But this might be a real way of actually making people feel a little bit more involved and a little bit more loved. So I think that's a positive thing. And I think that would be a positive thing for you, Tony, because you support an NFL club. I mean, if you got on the screen for 10 or 15 seconds or got to answer a question or something, I bet you'd be absolutely elated, wouldn't you?
Oh, absolutely. Listen, I think it's fantastic. And it is one of the things that's really struck me during this challenging time, having done lots of interviews with lots of different people, St. Albans and indeed global sporting stars, is just how indomitable the human spirit is, and how sometimes, again, I guess it's a truism that necessity is the mother of all invention. And we are embracing these type of technologies. And again, the positives far outweigh, I think, many of the negatives. But my only caveat would be, again, the visually, I think they're already there, but I think certain things have to do with sound interfacing in order to truly get that kind of visceral quality that's unique about live sport. And also, I know at this moment in time, everybody has got kind of social distancing and, you know, health and safety at the absolute paramount of our focus, and I suppose quite rightly so. But I genuinely would be reticent, whilst we've acknowledged all the advantages globally of fans and brands and sporting institutions embracing this ability to engage and cultivate relationships and have virtual fan experiences, I would loathe it. I think I would use that word loathe it if that ever became the norm, whereby there wasn't that human physicality, that raw emotion of a fan in an arena cheering on their team, whether that's in football, rugby, cricket, tennis, you name it. I would be wary about taking this technology and making it so that it is almost the new norm, if that makes sense. So that would be my caveat to this, but your thoughts briefly on that.
Yeah, I totally agree with you that I wouldn't want it to be the new norm, not at all. Fans need to be in stadiums. We don't just want them, they are needed there for the buoyancy of the team, but also supporting areas close by, keeping people employed, you know, catering staff. It goes from all levels, security staff. There's so many people involved with running a football club, sports club, rugby club, whatever kind of club you're supporting, that it's so, so important that we have fans back. And it also gives this connectiveness. So as long as it doesn't become the new norm that, oh, we're getting fans from around the world, then I'm all for it. And I think another caveat that I'd put to it as well is I hope that it doesn't become a product of almost like the ticket selling is now, you know, with Ticketmaster, and they go in and some ticket salesman buys all the tickets up for this fan experience and then puts them on eBay or something else for five times the amount. So it could be a £20 donation for a charity or something so that you appear on screen for 10 seconds with your child. Something really positive like that could then be turned into something horrible where somebody's charging £1,000 for those 10 seconds. I mean, that
virtual black market, the skin crawls, Jason. Goodness me.
It, and this is the problem with it. If it becomes a new norm, which I'm not opposed to in the sense that just people come on every so often, that's a good positive thing. You know, there's plenty of elderly fans that might never get to a stadium again because, you know, unfortunately they might not be well enough, but they could join in through hospital bed, nursing home, whatever, virtually. That would be fantastic. But if people are going to start charging a grand to do that sort of thing, that would need to be clamped down upon. So that's another problem that I see. But overall, if it's managed properly, like a lot of these things, it could be a really good positive thing. And yeah, I'm all for it, just to be done properly and not the new norm, like you said there, Tony.
Again, always want your views on this. The virtual fan experience. How will our experiences of live sports adapt, pivot and change both now and into the future? We'll love your views. Tweet us at Verulam Sport. Keep involved. Jason, moving things forward now, what else is on your hit list tonight?
Yeah, so kind of carrying it on, and maybe I'm being a bit too negative again, but I've called this bit the advent of being closer than ever, but never further away, because I think there's a real kind of divergence in football here, where one of the major appeals of football, and I think most sports in general, is that feeling that anybody can do it. And, you know, if you're a little bit too old or not ready yet in terms of your body, then maybe your son, your daughter, your sister, your brother, whatever, can do it instead. You can turn up with a bat and a ball to some empty car park, you got an object there as a stump, and suddenly you're in Lourdes. You know, you're about to win the Ashes, you're on the final bowl there. That feeling as the spectator that you could achieve it as a young child, God, that nothing beats it, does it? You bang home the winner in front of your friends at school, and then suddenly you're at the FA Cup final. But I would say in the current era of growing media around sports, around just looking into sport, what kind of worries me a little bit is that sport is now becoming almost a science in of itself. The positive thing for me as a data person, as a science-based person, I like the fact that they're making it more efficient than ever and this and that. But the sad thing is as well that growing up, you will probably never be able to replicate the training method. And if you're only very lucky to be scouted as a young child now, you probably won't ever make it because you'll be scientifically left behind because you won't be training in the best way, eating in the best way, and allotted all these special things that only a club of these behemoth size kind of afford to you. But also I would say as well, a growing negative trend of being further away from your club is the fact that a lot of clubs are now renovating stadiums so that they are there for the richer experience. And I mean that in the literal sense of money. It is a richer experience because you've got more boxes, you've got more of these things kind of laid on. And it's fun. You know, I have been lucky enough to kind of go on the stadium tour of Wembley, of Barcelona, of other clubs around Europe as well. And you go into the box and my goodness, you know, you get served this and that. Not that I've been there on a match day, but you kind of see what it would be like. And these are absolutely out of this world. But the sad thing is that now when you look at certain clubs, a lot of those turning up for match days are tourists or one-off individuals who are just coming there for seeing Arsenal. And it's the classic of Highbury Library on a grander scale. You know, these people kind of tut and look down on you. Oh, goodness me, he's stood up on his seat because he's singing. And I think that that's the fact that we're moving further away from the fans. But there's also this feeling, which I think is a really interesting thing, is that we're never closer than ever in terms of clubs, because we have these fly-in-the-wall documentaries, these exclusive interviews. And I think we've discussed it a little bit earlier about PR, but I think clubs are being clever here, in a sense, to allow documentaries into their clubs, into the background. And this kind of gives fans... So we've talked about the Amazon Prime one for Man City. There's a new one for Tottenham, but there's also the Drive to Survive for F1. And these sports are so disconnected from fans. They're so out there. But the same extent, it kind of gives the fan the feeling that, oh, I've seen this inside backroom argument that is obviously being allowed by F1 or these teams to be broadcast. You know, they're not going to really allow you too much insight into this or that argument. But it's very, very clever. But at the same time, I think it's just kind of appeasing fans again for the actual reality of the situation. I mean, look at Crystal Palace. They're now putting $100 million into a new stadium, and it's only actually going to up their attendances by a few thousand seats, because most of the seats being added are actually box ones. That's what they're worried about. They want that sort of thing. And I don't blame them at all. That's where the money's going to be. So there's this kind of clever thing by clubs of allowing more access, but it's special access that is going to be edited. But at the same time, they're moving further away. So I think that that's something that I've noticed there, Tony. And I don't know if you think this is a bad thing. Is it an irreversible thing? Because obviously these clubs are only going to get bigger and better. Or is there going to be a time where they grow so big that fans kind of lose heart and stop paying attention to the sport at all?
It's an amazing, amazing array of points and some really, really good questions there. For me, this kind of synthesizes with one of the earlier topics of conversation, which is why, given almost this paradox between the illusion maybe of that closeness and that's being part of a club through flying on the wall documentary, social media, whatever it may be, and the actual brute reality of that, again, it comes down to the overarching need. Forget money. I'm telling you, what is going to become increasingly critical is ensuring that the fan has a wonderful experience, that they want to return. Because I think the short-termism of the prawn sandwich brigade to the nth degree, you illustrated it with Crystal Palace, not having a go at them in particular, but I think it is short-term thinking. Where everything must come back is that if fans speak with their feet and stop attending, then that's going to change, pivot everything. And I think, therefore, this bridge is going to be the social media engagement and how teams must, they're already beginning to, if you consider this conversation, I don't know, 10 years ago, we would be talking in alien language, wouldn't we? This is actually a relatively new mode of interaction. And I think it's basically phenomenal. And for me, again, the critical thing that teams, clubs, brands across all sports need to be mindful of is how they embrace the voice of, for want of a better phrase, I don't know what the digital version would be, but the man on the street. Okay. The man with the tweet might be the modern parlance. I don't know. But the point's very simple. If they do that and they continue to do that, then that at least can appease that person. And that person then will want to be, feels invested. They feel like they're at least a part of something. They've always felt that. That's what it is to be a fan. But I just think this is absolutely critical. And again, if people or teams are forgetting their place, not just in the global scenario, but again, as a vital part of the community, whether that's London, whether that's St. Albans, whether that's Barnsley, it doesn't matter. Whatever the sporting team is, they are, will always be and must continue to be an absolutely vital mode and part of the community. And I think in embracing that in the digital community, the people that do that best, the teams that embrace that most openly, will be the ones who continue to thrive. Yeah, I just think that is for me, that's the critical thing, Jason, that this bridge is well managed between team and fan via that digital conduit, if all that makes sense.
No, I totally understand that, Tony. Quite a funny thing that I see in many football forums, communities like Reddit, you see so often that so-and-so's club has done a fantastic thing on Twitter. You know, they bantered with somebody that's tried to banter them. So, I don't know, maybe Tottenham replied to an Arsenal fan that said, oh, what have you won in the last few years? And they'll say, sorry, mate, can't hear you from up here in the top four. You know, something really hilarious like that. And it's really appreciated. And there's quite often, you know, funny tier videos or memes or whatever of the clubs with the best social media. You know, they might not be the best on the pitch, but my God, they'll beat you in the social media sphere. And it is a genuine thing now. There's almost an arms race to outdo each other, not just on the pitch, but on the social media front. It is fantastic. And that's something that you've really pointed out there, which again is going to be the future of the clubs. I mean, recently I saw a tweet where just a fan, you know, put a fairly innocuous tweet out of whichever football club likes this tweet, I will buy their kit for next season. This guy must be so out of pocket now, because over 700 people liked this tweet, one of which was Spartak Moscow in Russia. I mean, this is a guy, I think he was living up in Derbyshire or something. Mm-hmm. Why are they going through Twitter and liking this bloke's tweet? But my goodness, it was genius, because then people below were saying, look at Spartak Moscow once again, their social media team need a raise, etc., etc. And we saw this as well with our local Hertfordshire hero, Ian Allanson's granddaughter, Betty Lee. You know, loads and loads of clubs, whether it was tokenism or not, went in and supported her by giving her shirts, but also lay people as well sent her some stuff. And this is where the next arms race is, because if you can tap in with, say you send out a funny tweet and you get 20 more followers and then two or three of them buy your shirt, if you can do that exponentially through the season, keep growing and growing, that will then filter into the coffers of the club. They can do more respected. It's a really interesting game, and that could be another
it's
way.
It's absolutely fascinating, and continue to tweet us at Verulam Sport. We love your engagement. But Jason, on this point, I don't want to kind of advocate the devil here, because I think I've made my case very clear of how critical I believe this interface is now. But I wonder about the dangers of this kind of almost having a flip back onto pitch side activities. For instance, you know, is a Neymar infinitely more valuable, not necessarily for what he delivers on the pitch, but for his social media cachet? You know, and whilst I recognize how critical the digital community is, I'm worried if it becomes the case that then this becomes an influencing factor in team action, which, again, I don't think there should be a complete disparity between club activity, fan interaction. I think there needs to be that kind of openness, as I've already said. But I'm concerned about it kind of going too far the other way, whereby transfer decisions, you know, strategy, philosophy of a club is controlled, maybe heavily influenced by what social media possible gains are we going to get by being associated with X player. Again, it's a slightly different debate, but I'd love your take on it just quickly.
Well, kind of continuing again, I don't want to bang on too much about Le Prof, but Arsene Wenger warned about this. I've got down written here, actually, another quote from him, and he said, what has changed in football is that fans now follow their player not clubs anymore. So if a player changes club, he takes all the fans with him. Fan engagement has to be redefined accordingly. And you've just pointed it out there, Tony. When Cristiano Ronaldo moved from Real Madrid to Juventus, Real Madrid, so funnily enough, suddenly had far less fans. I wonder why. You know, the club value of Juventus doubled in a matter of months because of the individual. And this is something that may unfortunately shape club policy in the future. I think it's actually an inevitability, sadly enough, because the fact that it's almost seen now, not just that you're buying a player, but you're merging with a brand. And this is why image rights has become such a big controversial issue with footballers, that they get 50% of their share, 60%, whatever, for these team posters and whatnot. It's a really fascinating debate that has emerged in the world of football. When Pogba came to Manchester United, a lot of people were kind of questioning him because he spent too much time on social media. They thought that, oh, he's doing too much. We've seen it with Benjamin Mendy as well. Pep Guardiola has been critical of him because he's too much seen as a party boy, a playboy, whatever. So you can see the negative influence of maybe social media impacting clubs, who they're buying and whatnot. And I think it's something that worries me as well. With my own club, that Arsenal are now purchasing players who seem to be good rather than basing it on data and stuff. Whereas you've got clubs like Leicester who don't really care if you look good or you've got a good social media presence. They go with data, tactics and mind frame. Brentford as well. You know, Cliff Crown has told us many times, another one of our brilliant Hertfordshire guests, that the club don't really look at these sort of things of traction or whatever. We've seen it with clubs buying Asian players because of their trying to break into the market. It just doesn't make much sense to me. You're going to probably break more into that market if you're successful. So I totally agree with you, Tony, and I warn against clubs who actually want to go down that route, because at the end of the day, you might just end up signing a dud player who's going to cost you more on wages, more on the pitch, and might upset your dressing room as well, because people will go, well, he's not putting his work in, but he's still being played and paid just because he is who he is rather than what he does, you know. So it's a very worrying potential trend there, Tony.
Yeah, as I say, there are inevitably positives and the offshoot negatives. As always, want to get your views, all things social media and its influence in our world of sport. Tweet us at Verulam Sport. Now, the critical thing, though, that's really emanating out of this conversation for me is the need to evaluate and to move forwards the experience of a sporting event. And so there is that investment, and then there's the sense that you have been rewarded in every sense of that word for your investment in the team, the brand, the event, whatever it might be. And in that regard, just moving this conversation on forwards, some of the things, again, it embraces technology that I find really fascinating is the capacity already being embraced by, for instance, IBM in terms of tennis. Whereby, if you think about these days, the fastest servers, particularly in the men's game, you are blink and you miss it syndrome. I mean, literally, you've got less than half a second. And sometimes, I know there's wonderful replay facilities, et cetera, et cetera. And we all love Hawkeye, and we've had that wonderful chat. But what IBM have already kind of got on the cusp of being out there, if it isn't there yet, it's almost like an Oculus effect where the fans can then kind of pick it up and have that moment replayed virtually before their very eyes. So they can see and experience as if that ball being served at over 150 miles an hour or whatever it might be is coming at them. And I think that's amazing. I would love, for instance, that type of technology to be embraced by, for instance, boxing. Whereby I'm not suggesting that fans get a physical punch in the face, but a virtual experience of that knockout blow. Because again, thinking about the experience of that boxing kind of event, unless you have got the prime time seats to which you pay prime time dollar for ringside, then these guys are often just specs. And I know there's the atmosphere, which we love, which we need, which we've been talking about throughout this conversation. And I know, again, that there's that instant replay, big screen functionality. But to have that ability, just literally by putting on a pair of VR goggles or whatever, or maybe it could be downloaded as an app, whatever, to, again, just get that sense of what actually happened. Again, that could apply across all sports. How many times has it been where you've, you know, there's been a lull in play, you thought to yourself, oh, I'll tell you what, I'll beat the crowd, I'll nip to the loo, I'll get to the bar, whatever, come back and there's been a goal scored or whatever it might be. Well, again, not to have instant replay, but instant virtual rebooted action, I think is amazing. And it comes back, the technology's there. Like I say, IBM are already there or thereabouts with the Oculus effect for the serve. And like I say, I can only imagine it's going to be but a matter of time before that then is dispersed across all possible sports who want to embrace it. But the bottom line is that I bring this to the conversation is it is the enhancement of the live experience which all sports needs to embrace, because we are in an arms race for eyeballs. People are competing with Netflix and social media and et cetera, et cetera. And if sport doesn't take a leading stand in embracing these kind of technologies and thus enhancing that experience, then people will not keep coming back. Nobody anymore in the year 2020 can just rely on historical, traditional, you know, it was my dad's team, so it's my team kind of attitude. That's done. And I'm not saying it's a good thing or a bad thing. I'm simply saying we've got to deal with it. It is done. It's over. Teams need, therefore, to enhance the 360 experience. And they're just a few examples that off the top of my head that I've done a little bit of research into that I think tennis, boxing, and again, all other sports perhaps could really embrace. Quickly, your thoughts on those two aspects.
Yeah, no, I think exactly what you said there, the enhancement of the live experience. And I would bring in F1, you know, you watch it. And I always think of people that actually go. I've never been to an F1 race because of the reason that I think that you get a better viewing experience actually at home. Realistically, if you go to a stadium, you're only going to see a stretch of certain area and you'll see the cars come past. And obviously now it's a lot better. You'll know who's where and what. But realistically, you're only going to see a few seconds of action every so often. So that's always one that I've been a little bit interested in, because that is going to have to be a huge stadia experience that they're going to have to change to keep the eyeballs coming. Now, I think one thing there is that it is almost seen as like a little party. You know, you don't just go to the race. You go to P1, P2, P3, qualifying, all of those. It's like a whole weekend. And there's certain places like Monaco, for example, where it is not just about the race, but it's to be seen, to be at the right place at the right time. But I think a big problem for F1 with this Stadia experience is the lack of competitiveness at the moment. And we saw this happen with Schumacher, with Ferrari in the early noughties. People started turning off from F1. The races were boring because you knew who was going to win. The midfield doesn't really count too much because they're not going to win either. So I think they're going to have to not only work on the fan experience, like you said there, Tony, with VR or some sort of involvement on a higher level, but they're also going to have to sort out the rules so that Mercedes are less dominant, or so that the others catch up. And we've seen it before, you know, they tried to encourage Ferrari and other clubs, but I think people get a little bit angry with just trying to encourage the top teams. You know, the midfield and the lower teams also need to be encouraged as well. People now are quite often more interested in the battle for 10th. Who's going to get that final elusive point? And that's why people like Lando Norris have become almost the cult hero, because yes, he's young and he's really good with the, again, social media warfare kind of thing, or we shouldn't say warfare, but just engagement. But he's really good at that. But also, that's the most interesting race. Who's going to do it? Renault, McLaren, Haas, or all these clubs, these racing teams are actually far more interesting than Mercedes, who are at the top. So I think that's one thing. And also, you pointed out there with boxing. Now, how often was it in the 90s that you'd have Mike Tyson turn up? He was the big man on the card and he'd knock somebody out in, 20 seconds. And people had paid big, big money for the whole event. And obviously we have the undercards and the build up to the event. But it is this kind of, you've got on the pomp of the walk on and the pre and post analysis. It is becoming a big, big event. It's almost like the NFL's star-studded Super Bowl. You don't just watch a boxing match for 30 minutes of action of the big card. You now watch it for 4 or 5 hours because you want your money's worth. That's why you pay $18.99 to Sky. But like you said there, Tony, people aren't going to be sufficed with just that, because yes, it's nice to see some boxing, but I want to see the boxing. And this is where the extra experience, like you said there, of VR or exclusive content or fan experiences. You know, if you buy the rights to go Tyson Fury versus Deontay Wilder 3, maybe 1,000 fans get flown out or something. This is what needs to be done to save certain sports. I think F1 and boxing are potentially ones that might lose out. I think boxing a little bit less because it's experienced a renaissance recently, but F1 is definitely potentially going to lose out because Mercedes do not look like they're slowing up anytime soon. And maybe it has to come from rule change as well, but I think you're right there, Tony, with the rule, the experience has to be grander. And I don't know, do you think as well with the F1, there's almost been an aloofness for a while of it will sort itself out, we are the F1. Like you said, historically it's the biggest racing thing, but with EF1 coming through, that might take it over.
Yeah, I think there's an appetite for a sense of competition, and they have been, I think, complacent in that. Little disappointed in the new governing bodies. I was expecting, or maybe hoping naively perhaps, that when Max was kind of usurped and the big thinking Americans came over, I think we're talking maybe 2 seasons ago now, that would also coincide with an awareness that for all the bells and whistles, however you make it a big experience and embrace and enhance things through technologies, whatever it is, the core that keeps us coming, the calling of all sports, is that sense of competition, which has been eroded, particularly from the F1 scene, for a generation now. It's been a hegemony for McLaren. And credit to them. But yeah, I'm a little disappointed that more hasn't been done. But again, I think the issue here, as with so many sports, is that the brokers who relate to these big teams, who have the big sway with sponsors, et cetera, have all the influence. And so we have in sports, I think the F1 world is sadly a rather good illustration of this, but it pans pretty much all sports, where there is this situation at the moment. Maybe it's been there forever, I don't know. But whereby the rich get richer and everybody else is just after a few crumbs to be and almost considered privileged to be at least at the banquet. Well, again, that's all very well and good, but all of a sudden now the competition with e-racing, where I believe to a certain degree every car has the same kind of spec, for want of a better phrase, meaning therefore the thrust, the focus, there's no debate, the best drivers are going to be the ones who are taking it all home. Again, if they don't react, then like you say, if you're just a common racing fan who you want to see high octane, motorsport at a competitive level, well, there's no longer just the hegemony of F1. There are choices. And the fact that I think that they are aware of this is going to be fascinating to trace how they handle this, how the flow of money is controlled, and what other technological advances or maybe limiters at the highest levels are going to be imposed in order to save the sport. Because people can be short-termist, but it's a crazy attitude. It's a crazy attitude. Because at the end of the day, you know, if you are Mercedes, McLaren, or Ferrari, or whatever, well, you need all the other teams to compete against in order for there to be F1. And there will only be F1 if there are fans who are going to be turning up, paying their big bucks to have that experience of those 4 days and keep on keeping on. But I'm telling you, one of the things that's absolutely critical is that if people are not mindful of the product and making sure that the product will outlive whoever's in control, because that ain't going to last for but a small lifetime. If you're lucky, whether it's F1, it's a great illustration. Whether it's NFL, rugby, cricket, golf, tennis, whatever. If teams are not, and the governing bodies of all of these sports are not conscious of how to move things forwards, then you're like the dinosaur. You will die out. It's fascinating. However, I'm going to throw this one at you, Jason, because this week in athletics, big, big changes in the long jump. And I thought, to be honest, that was a case of almost tweaking for tweaking's sake. I don't know if you've heard this, but if you haven't, so a long jump competition is usually over, I think, 6 rounds, and then the individual's best round would then be, well, you know, whatever's the best over those 6 rounds could be on round two. You could have been disqualified 5 of the times, but if you set the longest jump in round two and nobody else was able to surpass that, then you get the gold, the silver, the whatever it is in context, right? It's been like that forever and a day. Now, this most recent Diamond Games, instead of having that winning leap being the winning leap, it was almost a leap off, where after 5 rounds, I believe it was, everything was then put on neutral, and the top 5 teams before then had a one-off jump each, but almost negating all the previous rounds. Now, lots of greats in the sports, Carl Lewis, who's, you know, an Olympian of great repute, was vehement in this, being just tweaking it for the sake of tweaking it. And it's obviously its remit, its focus, and its justification was that then it draws eyeballs into this kind of do or die final leap, if that makes sense, which I get. But for me, just personally speaking, I just don't see that. I just think that's forgetting all the different tensions of the game, the sport, in those 6 previous rounds, and making it almost a leap off for a leap off sake. Not a fan of that. Love your views, though. Do tweet us at Verum Sports. But Jason, like I say, there's this weird balancing act, isn't there, which all sports is facing, which is the need to sort of honour and keep true to their traditions and mould it, enhance it, to use that key word again, without losing the spirit of the sport. This is going to be such a challenge. And I think that's what this period of time has really thrust into our consciousness now. Just quickly, your thoughts on that tweaking for tweaking's sake, as I see it, in the long jump arena.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it sounds a bit like the playoffs in the championship. You know, you've done all the work all season, or in this case, in the trials up till that final jump there. And then it's all down to one. And yeah, I think, like you said there, it's tweaking for tweaking's sake. It's putting too much drama. But then for the other reason, the athletics are probably thinking, oh, this means all eyes on the final, which is something. It adds drama, but I think it takes a little bit away from it as well for me. I mean, it's kind of like looking back at some great rule changes in F1. The double diffuser, when Braun GP kind of exploited that loophole, that was probably the saving grace for a couple of seasons for Formula One. People then started buying into the story of, oh, well, Braun GP literally created at the start of this season, won the F1 championship. Maybe things have changed in F1. And I think that got a lot of people re-hooked in. And then Red Bull came to the fore and people thought, oh, well, Red Bull's a new team as well. But it's kind of gone back to, as you said, their hegemonic powers of Mercedes. The big boys are back at the top. There was a slight blip. And it happened with the Premier League as well. You know, there wasn't specific rule changes, but, you know, God bless Claudio Ranieri with Leicester. He made people believe in the narrative of anybody can win. And for a little while, you know, people started to believe that. And there was that lovely story of them progressing to the quarterfinals of the Champions League as well. Jamie Vardy is a living, breathing embodiment of you can do whatever you want to do in football as long as you work hard and believe. But the Premier League now, kind of linking this to the Athletics thing, will they have to start making rule changes to the actual style of football? Because Liverpool and Man City don't look like they're going to be caught up for a long while. Liverpool have done it in a very smart way by investing in data and scouting and things like that, which Man City have had to catch up with building this kind of huge complex, etc., etc. But those two, for many seasons now, but anything can change, look set. Manchester United have tried to compete with money, but haven't spent it well. Chelsea are spending big this year, but realistically, with their defence, with their goalkeeper issue, can you see them competing? And then the previous, you know, big clubs like Arsenal, Tottenham, and even Leeds, who are back in the Premier League, which is fantastic again for the Premier League. But realistically, it's going to be a story of the best of the rest, people avoiding relegation. I mean, last season, you and I talked at length about how the season was basically over by January with Liverpool. It was now the most interesting thing was who's going to get Europe and who's going to get relegated. That's what people tuned in for, especially in lockdown. And these are big things that, you know, FIFA, the FA are going to have to consider linking it with the Athletics thing. It might be tinkering for tinkering's sake, but some of these might actually save the sport. So again, linking it to the experience as well of fans, if Burnley or clubs like that kind of get mid-table with boring football, that might deter fans. So should there be penalties or something at the end of games? Not that I'm advocating it, but that just seems like something that might be debated. There's all these sorts of important discussions that are probably going to be on the horizon very soon, because it's on a knife edge as well. With COVID, people are going to start considering, well, do I really need a season ticket? You know, I've enjoyed watching it from home. Do I need this new shirt? There's all these kind of sorts of considerations that are going to come to the fore. And people might start turning off as well because there's other more interesting sports as well, or other better pastimes. So I don't know what you think about that one, Tony. Is there going to be a power vacuum with a lot of these sports as people just turn off because of the dominance?
Yeah, I think there's a real problem that has to be considered. Again, not easy to have the solution to that one. But for, just to give an illustration from cricket perspective, a fascinating test series. Long-time listeners to Verum Sport podcasting and Verum Sport generally will know that I'm a little bit of a dinosaur. I'm a test match man over a 2020 man, for instance. You know, I love the nuances of a longer version of the game. And the point is, in the second test against Pakistan, having England had an amazing, astonishing, heroic victory in the first test, where Chris Wokes, friend of the show, Chris Wokes, and, you know, Joss Butler combined for an improbable mid-wicket, mid-wicket salvo, seeing England home in that first test. Again, at this moment in time, it's the only test series going on across the globe, granted in an empty arena for reasons that are obvious. But there's no football at present. Rugby at that point had not yet returned Premier League rugby, zero Premier League. So cricket almost, if you were just a kind of floating fan of sport, looking for your sporting fix, was in the shop window. And that first test was such a wonderful advert for the qualities that I adore about test match cricket. The ebbs and flows, the momentum shifts, the partnership elements, and the sheer willpower that Wokes and Butler embodied to see us home. Now, given all that, coming into the next second test, again, with the notion that cricket and test cricket is fighting for its very existence, as indeed all sport is, the second test, you know, if you'd heard all this hype but didn't watch that first test, but were maybe like, well, goodness me, this England cricket team looks like, or sounds like anyway, they've got something to offer. Let me just check this out, right? You're greeted with less than a day and a half play. I'm not having a go at the umpires. They were following protocol. But that wasn't rained out. It was through, quote unquote, bad light. And again, you're a neutral. You've never been a test match man or never been a cricket fan. You're a neutral sports fan seeking out your sporting fix. And you'd heard this wonderful hype about that first test. How perplexing is this when you are witnessing no action because of quote unquote bad light, but they've got all the floodlights on. And as far as you can see, it looks okay. So again, no, I understand health and safety. I get that. But for goodness sake, some common sense has got to come into play, you know, and maybe there's talk about maybe changing the colour ball or at least having that option, or in England, maybe starting test matches a little bit earlier to draw, eke out as much play. But whatever it is, cricket had that golden opportunity then to really build momentum, to attract new fans who then may become new players. And that's with that beautiful synergy that sport lives and breathes with. And it was just a farce. It was an absolute French farce. Because like I say, I found it farcical. I'm a fan of test match cricket, have been all my life. But if you've never witnessed it, tuning in for the first time, you're seeing floodlights, no action. It's mental. It's absolutely mental. And they need the world cricket and indeed all sports. This is the point, really. Need to embrace and enhance that experience of sport, but they need to do that also on that next tier level where the fans' engagement is available, enhanced, etc., etc. And, you know, that theme is the key. It's the key for all sport at this vital moment in time for me.
I was going to ask as well, moving on to maybe your favourite sport, I don't know if it combats NFL, but with rugby, with Saracens, do you think it might be a positive thing for spectators that they have been relegated? You know, next season and this season, we're going to see somebody breaking that traditional Saracens at the top, which they have been for so many seasons. And a lot of people here will maybe point out, oh, well, it's jealousy or of a club doing very well. Mm. I get that. But, you know, when Manchester United stopped winning, people started paying attention maybe a little bit more to the Premier League. Like I said there, when Leicester lifted that trophy, people were suddenly fell in love with the Premier League once again. Exeter have done a fantastic job of kind of cultivating talent. They haven't spent big, but they've done really well with their stuff. I wouldn't say it's 100% comparable to Leicester, but it is a romantic story nonetheless. Could rugby's saving grace and golden moment now be without Saracens at the top, even if it's just for a season?
It's such a good conversation. I'd like to pick this up maybe another time with Brian Quinn, and I'd love your views on this. Do tweet us at Verulam Sports, because for me, the bigger issue in terms of rugby and its fan engagement is that for too many years, they've been tweaking rules for tweaking rules' sake. So now there's just nobody seems to actually referee the offside line. The scrum has become an absolute farce. And because it's gone so far down that road, there's talk now in terms of almost moving away from scrummaging, which for me would signal the death knell of the sport, being sacrificed on the altar of entertainment. No, go back, but simplify. Go back and simplify. And it is these core confrontational qualities that will always draw in a fan base. Sports like rugby, cricket, boxing and a whole others have to stop trying even to aspire to be football, because they can't be. What they need to focus in on is their core strengths and then strategically spread the word and build in a loyal, sustainable fan base. That is going to be the future for all sports. Football is in a different category. It's a different animal. But I think your point there is fascinating, because what's going to be really fascinating to observe from a Saracens perspective is, again, coming back to that fan experience. I don't know the specific details, but I know, thankfully, they've been managed to retain an awful lot of their key core star names, Farrell, Itoje, a whole list of others. But what's going to happen is they're going to play quite a few matches against South African teams, I think, in almost like a touring, Harlem Globetrotters-esque kind of experience next season. Almost inevitably, they will get promoted back and be a premiership force and then be fighting to gun for silverware upon their return. But now it's going to be fascinating to witness how Saracens embrace this transitional time. I think the good of the sport, like you say, is that people are open to a new name on the title, which will be the case this campaign. Watch out for Bristol, by the way. Massive appreciation for what Pat Lam is constructing there down in that South West club. Rugby, I think, is in a strong place, but what they need to consider, as I've said, is a massive, massive issue. It's been a massive, massive issue for probably about 30 years on and off. And that is, they have just confused people by making nuanced, minutiae law changes that haven't enhanced the product. And that's a bigger problem for rugby. But this, for me, has been a proper, interesting conversation. As always, it is. And as always, I'm grateful for you for giving us this debate. Make sure you're with us next Saturday, 6 till 7 on 92.6 FM, where there'll be more of the same. And always, it will be of your choosing. So do tweet us at Verulam Sport. But Jason, in closing, it's been a fascinating, compelling conversation. What are your takeaways from this chat?
I think my main takeaways are going to be that sport is kind of at a crossroads now, maybe compiled by COVID, but they need to make some wise decisions. I think one point there that you've said is that they need to simplify and engage with the user experience, listen to the fans. But I would also say that there's positives as well. You know, we have discussed some positive things. Maybe I'm a little bit too negative on some of these aspects. But overall, I think there are a lot of positive aspects that we can draw from football and its unifying nature that we have seen during this crisis. I think we've spelled out some of the things that fans can expect and why they're experiencing the things that they are. And hopefully, with rugby, with F1, with all these things, that these problems can be sorted. But what would you say is your final points, and maybe nicely tie it up in a big positive bow, Tony?
Well, there was that old one, isn't there, that at any crossroad there is opportunity. I think now sport has an opportunity, because whilst we're all reevaluating, one of the things that is coming through is that there is still this vacuum in our life that is sport. And I don't ever envisage that going away. So we have an appreciation, perhaps, for the role of sport to lift us up and to inspire us all. And that's maybe become more acutely appreciated. I think that's a good thing. But what's critical is that sports in all of its beautiful forms recognizes this opportunity and, as you say, listens in closely and focuses in on their ancient spirit, but embodies that in a modern way without just tweaking for tweakage's sake, but to work strategically to ensure that the product that we will go on to enjoy for years and years and years, and I would hope for ad infinitum, is always the very, very best possible experience that it can be. And that is my final thought on this compelling conversation. But I know you listening are awash with opinions. Do tweet us in at Verulam Sport. Anything that you think we've covered that you'd like to pick up apart, or anything that you think we've missed when it comes to what sport's role is in enhancing your experiences of it, both live and at home. Continue to tweet, continue to stay involved. Enjoy our podcasts. Make sure you're tuning into 92.6 FM next Saturday, 6th through 7, where yet again we will be debating an aspect of sport of your call. So it's been cool to speak with you, Jason McKenna, the machine, to have you involved out there. Keep involved. But for now, all the very best. Keep well, keep safe. Thanks for listening.